And then I'm staring at the adult texts that are next to me and thinking, when can I possibly do this for it to feel right? Because first you're eating and everyone's chatting and eating, and then the kids run off, and then the adults are left to their own devices, but everyone's having some wine and people are getting tipsy and the conversation's getting heated about all kinds of things. There's never an easy moment where you say, can we just pause between the mashed potatoes and the sweet potatoes and talk about genocide?
I've had these conversations with friends, and sometimes I feel like, not this particular conversation, but conversations about other sensitive topics. And sometimes I feel like it's better to give people heads up, or maybe just give them a warning of, you know, we'll talk about this thing, so that they either come prepared, and if they are uncomfortable, you know, I mean, they can let you know. So I'm so excited to have you here again. For listeners who have been regular listeners of the show, they know Lisa. She's a dear friend, and she did two episodes with me. One was called What's in a Name, where we talked about why immigrants change their name when they come to the U.S., and the other one was Lisa's own journey to the U.S. And today, Lisa and I will be talking about our Thanksgiving, the way we celebrated it, some myths about it. So this is our Thanksgiving special. I'm so excited, Lisa, you're here.
Thank you so much for having me back, Sadia. I'm very excited too.
Let's start with your Thanksgiving. How was it?
It was different. For me, Thanksgiving this year was all about letting go of some expectations about how things were going to go. So what we do in my family is we do a Friendsgiving, and we do it not on the Thursday, but on the Saturday. And it really was born out of my husband and myself both being people who are far from their families and don't necessarily love to travel through the snarl of, like, air travel and roads on Thanksgiving. So for years, he used to go to a Friendsgiving in Washington, D.C., which was also full of young people who were far from their families. And then when he and I got together, I would go with him to that one. And then when we had kids, we said, let's start our own Friendsgiving tradition. So we would invite friends over and then try to focus on other people who didn't have family close by, whether they were friends. For 2 years, we hosted international students from a nearby language school. And this year, I had a new idea to invite friends who didn't have family around, but also to include a refugee family or another recent immigrant family in our celebration. So I worked really hard. I partnered with a local organization called Hearts and Homes for Refugees, and we found a family who wanted to celebrate with us, an Afghani family, and I was ready to find a halal turkey and to go to great lengths to make this all work. And then in this amazing thing that totally transcends all place and culture, it turned out that the husband with whom I'd been corresponding had not consulted with his wife about whether they were free that day. So he wrote back to me and said, oh, sorry, I know I confirmed, but I just talked to my wife and found out that we have plans, which, like, happens in every family I know all the time.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of cancellations. So we went down from 26 to 15 and had, which was actually, I think, the perfect number of people. So I had to deal with a little bit of just, like, being disappointed and having to kind of roll with things going not quite as planned. And then my husband had a ton of work to do the whole weekend. So on Thursday, when we didn't have any plans for the first time in a long time, he worked from 8 in the morning to 10 at night. And the kids and I just climbed the walls of our house all day. And I would just look at social media and see everybody with, like, pies and turkeys and friends and kids, and actually felt kind of sorry for myself.
You know, you mentioned Friendsgiving. So I have been celebrating Thanksgiving for the last, I don't know, decade and a half. And that's one holiday that I really connect with because I feel like I don't celebrate Christmas. And this is one holiday where I can just connect with my American identity. Most of the time I celebrated with my friends. I have siblings in the US, but we never got a chance to celebrate it together. Why should we have this distinction between, like, Thanksgiving with family and Thanksgiving with friends and call it a different name?
It's an interesting question. I've never really thought about it before, but I think it's something for which there has been a yearning among young people who moved far from families for college or work opportunities and who are clustered in places like Washington, D.C., where we used to celebrate, in New York, where so many people are far from home and are looking for, you know, for the family that we choose, the family that we create with each other. And that kind of interdependence shows itself in different ways, like, you know, being far from home and not having grandparents now to help us. So we try to help each other. And we have dear friends who join us for Friendsgiving who recently celebrated their 10-year anniversary, but they had no one to leave their almost 6-year-old daughter with. So as our present to them for their 10-year anniversary, we had her sleep over at our house for the first time so they could go get a night away at a bed and breakfast. So They have come to our Friendsgiving for years now, and, you know, I think of them as family, but there's something sweet about recognizing that we all have that need to create family with each other.
Yeah. So last year, and I've been doing this for the last 2 years, where I hosted Thanksgiving with extended family and once with friends. But this year, my siblings and I decided that we were not going to do it at one of our homes and we'll just go somewhere else. And of all the places, we decided to go to Charleston, South Carolina. Have you ever been?
I have, very briefly for work once.
So did you get to see the town?
Not really.
Oh my God. So we went and I'll be honest, we all have these stereotypical notions of what a place is like, and especially like people and what the conversation was before we left was all about, you know, why are like 12 brown people deciding to go to Charleston and, you know, get that gaze. I don't know if you're familiar with the gaze. I was so scared. I spoke to a friend of mine and my brother was so excited about the historical aspects of Charleston. And he was like, no, you know, there's so much history and architecture and we should go. So we ended up being there. I was basically banking on Southern hospitality. And I was like, you know, whatever the case, I mean, Southern people are known for their hospitality. But I didn't find people as warm and welcoming as I would have expected, because in New York, when I walk around, my expectation is everybody is rude. So you're not surprised, you know, nobody smiles at you. When I go to Chicago to visit my sister, people smile at you. They really do, sometimes to the point where you think something's wrong with you. And then when I went to Charleston, people were just angry, not at us, but just generally not happy.
That's so interesting. I haven't been to Charleston, but what you said about New York versus Chicago is so funny to me, because in a way, I think New Yorkers are so honest on the surface, which means that they're like frustrated and mad and trying to get somewhere and elbowing you. But in a pinch and when you need something, I feel like New Yorkers really help each other out. I had this incident a really long time ago where, embarrassingly, like right after New Year's, I didn't have breakfast one morning. I was in my mid-20s and I fainted on a subway car. I was just standing in my hot coat and I hadn't had any water and I was rushing to work. And I passed out and I woke up and I was on my back with like 30 concerned people standing over me, and somebody gave me tea and somebody picked me up and somebody got out at my stop and sat with me for as long as I need to feel better. And I was like, everybody needs to know I'm not on a diet. I was like so embarrassed. It was January 3rd and I was like, everybody thinks that I'm just like starving myself and passing out on the subway. It was a total fluke. But I do think there's something to that, that people can be very honest on the surface with all their frustrations, but when it comes to the things that matter, they're really helpful. Whereas like what you're describing about Chicago is like to a Russian immigrant is like the stereotype of Americans. Like they're so nice on the surface, they're so friendly, but you wonder what's wrong because like it doesn't seem real.
You know, that's what my husband says about Denver, because we've lived in Denver for a few years and everybody was just so nice on the surface. But then he wasn't happy with his experience at work and otherwise. And I think it goes back to what you just said, that it's better to be honest on the surface and be who you are and then be there for others when they need you.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So coming back to your Thanksgiving, you and I were talking about something important that happened this time, right? And I, like, as I said, I am very connected to this holiday. But this time, since I've been doing this podcast for almost a year, I was like, something piqued my curiosity about history of Thanksgiving. And I started doing research. And I found certain things that were just so unsettling for me that I wasn't really 100% into my Thanksgiving celebrations the way I normally am. And you felt that too. In fact, you shared this podcast, Red Nation podcast, on your Facebook page, which basically debunks some of the pilgrim mythology and it talks about it in detail. That was an eye-opening experience for me. Did the same thing happen to you? What was Thanksgiving like in terms of the historical context of it?
Yeah, so it was exactly the same for me. You know, since we started celebrating our Friendsgivings, I always have loved this holiday, really enjoyed it. I love the connection to food. I love that people are with their families. I love the idea of being thankful and kind of sharing our gratitudes. And it's such a sweet thing to instill in the kids. So I had brought like a real, I think, ignorant, in my case, innocence to it. And actually, I remember last year, the place that we went to celebrate our Thanksgiving, one of the kind of older members of that family had brought these pilgrim hats. And my dad was with us and he wore one and it looked great on him and it was hilarious. And I really honestly didn't think that much of it or what that pilgrim hat symbolized. And I know that, you know, one of my family members definitely, you know, said something or kind of very quietly whispered something about, like, you don't have to wear them. And it didn't even really register what she was talking about. But this year, you know, I think I've been on a very similar journey to you about just kind of deepening into a lot of different corners of the social justice world that are usually ignored. And I've really come to realize how absent Indigenous issues are, even from social justice spaces, like on the international scene. I've been part of an international conference on kind of social justice through the arts, and there was barely any mention of Indigenous issues, or very, you know, almost no Indigenous artists who were represented. The same thing for many conferences and other spaces where you just don't even hear about it. So I thought to myself, this is something I really need to look into. And so you're right. So I asked, I'm very fortunate. I have a friend, a dear friend, whose daughter is an enrolled member of a tribe and also a Native American studies scholar and professor. And I said, please, you know, send me some resources. And she shared this podcast, which I recommend to all of your listeners, the Red Nation podcast on debunking the pilgrim myths, as well as how to find out what tribal land you're on and some books and articles.
Oh, my God. By the way, you have to send me that link because I want to find out what Native American land do we inhabit now, because I was doing some research online and I couldn't find it.
Yeah, I could actually share it in a moment with your listeners, and everybody can go onto this link and find out whose land you're on. I did that. And for me in Irvington, New York, it is Lenape and Wappinger land. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, just that act in and of itself was really meaningful, to actually put these tribal names to the very kind of generic idea of a people who seem to be missing. And that actually made me reflect on, like, the education that I got in America after I moved here, which definitely, even if they didn't say, oh, Native American people are extinct, created this impression that they're gone. It was this kind of, like, romantic notion of once there was a people, and it's all very lamentable. It would be great if they were still here, but some bad things happened that we're not going to get into in detail, and now they're gone. Yeah. And that's not true. So it really kind of piqued my interest in learning more and in bringing this to my Thanksgiving. And that's where I also had to deal with a lot of, like, hopes and expectations that I couldn't realize.
You know, Lisa, you're so brave because you do that. We are friends on Facebook as well. And I see your posts and you're always, like, vocal about social issues. And I do that too. But it's not easy to broach all these different subjects because, like, when we were on our trip to Charleston, South Carolina, when we arrived there, we had this conversation about Native Americans and we were also talking about slavery. And my husband was like, can we not talk politics on this trip? And from his vantage point, I understand where he's coming from, because sometimes I think I just get too emotional and I get too, I guess, invested in things. And I, like, when I talk about those things, it just may sound as argumentative. But I was also in a way disappointed that we couldn't talk about it, and somehow I had to just shut my mouth and you just focus on family gossip and taboo and all of that, where I would have loved to talk about what you're saying. And you had a similar experience, not a similar experience, but you couldn't really bring it up, right?
Yeah. So, well, when you said that you were too emotional, like, my back totally went up, because I was like, you're not too emotional. You're appropriately emotional.
Yeah.
Because when you actually let yourself feel these things, you can't, it's not a matter of fact kind of thing. And it reminds me of when I was still practicing law, I was representing a client in a sexual harassment case, a woman who had been harassed in the workplace. And I needed to go to a mediation and deliver a statement about the things that had happened to her. And I was practicing in front of a partner who was kind of coaching me. And I delivered my opening statement. And he said, you know what? You, coming from you, this young woman, you're a feminist. You know, I know this about you. You need to bring emotion to this. And I was like, oh, there's some things you can't say, like you're just ordering coffee, you know, and that's really true. Like, you can't talk about genocide like you're just ordering coffee. So you were not too emotional. I just want to say that. You were appropriately emotional. But yeah, you're right. I had a lot of trouble bringing this up. I had these, like, printouts of this original speech by Wamsutta James, which was actually the beginning of the Native American National Day of Mourning, which is now in its 50th year. And the way that it began was there was going to be this, I think it was the 350th anniversary of the so-called pilgrims, we'll get to that in a minute, landing at Plymouth Rock. They didn't actually land at Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock is tiny and no one can land there. But there was going to be this kind of big celebration, and the descendants of the pilgrims thought, wouldn't it be nice to invite a Native American person to speak here? So they invited this man, Wamsutta James, also known as Frank James, and they said, can you say a few words, but just show us your speech in advance. And he showed them his speech, and they said, oh, no, 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 no. You can't say any of this, because the speech was really about, this is what happened to my peoples, and there was a genocide, and, you know, we have been systematically erased, and the true story of Thanksgiving has been completely left out, and this is what I'm here to say, that we're resistant, and we're resilient, and we're still here. So they said, no, you can't possibly say that. You need to edit this. And he said, I'm not editing this. So he went, and he delivered the speech somewhere else for a Native audience, and that was the first National Day of Mourning. So anyway, I printed out that speech, and I printed out another really beautiful kind of reflection on Thanksgiving from a Native American woman who said, I do celebrate Thanksgiving, but this is what I'm celebrating. I'm celebrating the possibility of kind of coming to terms with what happened and moving forward together in honesty. And I wanted to read these, you know, for the mostly for the adult members of our gathering. And I also bought some children's books, including a really beautiful book. I think it's called Thanksgiving Morning Message, or Giving Thanks a Morning Message, which is really just a beautiful tribute to the earth and the bounty of the earth. And it comes from a tradition of doing this in the morning with Native American children to remind them how connected we are to the earth and her, all of her fruits. So I tried to do that. So imagine we have 15 people, 7 of them are children, 5 and under. Like within 2 seconds, like mashed potatoes are smeared on the wall. Cranberry sauce is like all over the floor. The kids are crying. My daughter, who's 4, sat down. And 2 seconds later, she was like on the floor having a tantrum. I can't remember why. So I'm standing there. Everybody's hungry, like looking at their bowl of soup with this book, trying to just read the children's book. And I wound up reading it, but like no one was listening. And the kids were all over the place. And the adults were eating, which I told them to do because I didn't want the soup to get cold. So that was like completely lost. And then I'm staring at the adult texts that are next to me and thinking, when can I possibly do this for it to feel right? Because first you're eating and everyone's chatting and eating, and then the kids run off, and then the adults are left to their own devices, but everyone's having some wine and people are getting tipsy and the conversation's getting heated about all kinds of things. There's never an easy moment where you say, can we just pause between the mashed potatoes and the sweet potatoes and talk about genocide?
I've had these conversations with friends, and sometimes I feel like, not this particular conversation, but conversations about other sensitive topics. And sometimes I feel like it's better to give people heads up, or maybe just give them a warning of, you know, we'll talk about this thing, so that they either come prepared, and if they are uncomfortable, you know, I mean, they can let you know. So do you think if you had to send an email and saying that we will be talking about something that's, you know, dear to me, I've done some research and just come prepared, do you think it would have had a different effect?
Yeah, I think it would have, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like as easy a crowd of people to do this. And as you can imagine, it's all people our age, you know, relatively young people who I think are relatively progressive. So this is not like the most difficult crowd, but still figuring out how to bring it up and how to insert it and how to like take everybody kind of to a mental place where you have more spaciousness in the conversation for people to reflect in the middle of like a party is really hard. So I think if I had warned people, it's not even just about preparing themselves for by reading or doing any of that, but maybe like some of them would have brought it up or helped me find the right moment. And actually what you just said reminded me of something very cool. A friend who knew we were recording this episode sent to me. She sent me an article that was written by a Native American comedian who was invited, and he was the first Native guest to be invited on a podcast dedicated to reviewing weird and dumb video games. But he was invited to review Custer's Revenge, which is a video game in which a Native woman gets raped by the ghost of General Custer. And he was invited to do a Thanksgiving episode about this game. And when he got the invitation, he just like his jaw dropped because he was like, I'm a Native man being asked to do this thing on Thanksgiving, my National Day of Mourning, about this incredibly offensive game. what am I even supposed to do or say? And so he deliberated a lot about whether to kind of say nothing about it. And as he said, kind of like pass the buck of this microaggression to the next, you know, native comedian they invite, or to just like put this on the internet so that everybody kind of validates him and says how awful it is. But what he decided to do was to accept the invitation and send the podcasters a heads up that he was going to bring a serious conversation about representation to their podcast. So they had their intro and they had like 20 minutes of banter. And then he said, okay, I have to tell you something. What the fuck? And then he just went on, you know, this long diatribe about how incredibly offended he was and how he couldn't understand why, as a Native person, he was asked to talk about this game, except that Native women are 2.5 times more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted than any other woman in the United States. But why should he, as a Native man, be talking about that? Mm. Because Native men are mostly the perpetrators. And he said, like, after he said this, just all the air went out of the room, because clearly when they had responded saying, yeah, of course we can have a serious conversation, they had no idea
what kind
how
of conversation
serious it is. So the conversation after that got really quiet and everyone kind of had to take in all of this hurt. But afterwards, they all sent him individual apologies and said they want to have him back for a more fun episode, and said they want him to frame the narrative around this episode and name it so it can be comfortable for him, that they wanted recommendations for other Native guests who they want to invite, not in a tokenizing way, not on Thanksgiving, but like at some other time. And that just this really reverberated through the like comedian podcaster community and had a big impact on other people.
Sometimes I'm surprised at why people who've native born have very little information about Native American history and genocide. I believe Native American genocide is the least talked about genocide in the history of genocides. And to me, it ties back to the same idea of romanticizing wars and invasion in U.S. And we see that manifestation of that in U.S. foreign policy as well, right? We see that when we went into Iraq, same thing happened. It's the same, even with slavery. And I want to point out something that happened while we were in Charleston. We took this carriage tour, and the guide, he was a nice guy. He was talking about history of slavery. And the narrative that he was trying to push was that slavery was not as prevalent in Charleston or in South Carolina, and that slaves were not, they were treated better than what is taught in schools or in history books. And honestly, for me, it just ties, everything ties together, this idea of not reconciling with your history, whether it's Native American history, whether it's slavery. How do people reconcile with all of that?
That's a huge question. And it's so important, both for reconciling, as you say, with the history of the genocide of Native American people and the history of slavery and the legacy of slavery. And it's extremely hard to do, in part because if we actually experience emotionally and truly what these things are, then we would have to act. And then we would have to ask the question, what do we do? And what do reparations look like for something on such as massive a scale as the death of tens of millions of people?
We are already fighting about reparations for African-Americans, aren't we?
Yes, and that's extremely contentious. I hope that that will come to fruition, you know, in our lifetime and hopefully quite soon. But I think, as you say, the piece of the Native American genocide is even harder for people to talk about, because that has to do with the land, the physical land that we are on, which we either will continue to inhabit or we have to give back. And that is something that goes even deeper in terms of figuring out how to reconcile with it and what to actually do about it. And what this kind of, what really brought this home for me was recently actually reading a book called The Lemon Tree, which is this beautiful, incredible book about the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But it was really about two individual people, an Arab-Palestinian man and an Israeli Jewish woman of Bulgarian origin who had lived in the same house. So the Palestinian man's family, you know, had this house, built this house in land that his ancestors, you know, had inhabited. And he was an indigenous person living on that land. And then, during the Nakba, what is known to Palestinians as the catastrophe, his family was forcibly expelled from this house. And the people who settled there were Bulgarian Jews who were fleeing the Holocaust. I mean, very sympathetic people who had no idea what had happened to Palestinians or that they had been there or whose house it was. It was just known as an Arab house, which was really a kind of architecture. Like, it wasn't really even thought of, like, who were the people. It was just an architectural style. And so this Bulgarian family settled in the house. And eventually, when the Israeli woman was about 20, and by the way, this is a true story, this is not a work of fiction. When she was about 20, there was a knock on the door, and she opened the door to three young Palestinian men, and she knew exactly who they were. She had wondered her whole life, who were the people who owned this house before me, who planted the lemon tree in my yard? And they developed this beautiful relationship that was really interesting and complicated and very honest, and that lasted for decades through all of the wars and the two intifadas and all of the things that actually happened in that part of the world. And the part that was most resonant for me was how they discussed what would happen to the land and what it meant that they couldn't both inhabit the same house, and that he, this Palestinian man, had a claim to the very soil on which she had grown up. And as sympathetic as she was to him, and as much as she was really a very early and unusual ally of Palestinians, she wasn't ready to give the house back. Or even if she was ready, and eventually she was ready to give the house back, she couldn't say that that's what every Israeli should do. You know, she said, my people came here. We were also innocent of this history. We were fleeing the Holocaust. We're here now. This is our home now. So what do we do? And they never actually found a solution in the book. You know, it was very honest about that.
Doesn't it show us a pattern of how British have conducted themselves in a way? It happened when Jews were fleeing persecution. The Allied forces decided to create this home for them in Palestine. And the same thing happened in a way in the U.S. So do you see a pattern of colonialism manifesting itself in different forms?
Yeah, and I think the one of the uniting factors is that, you know, in Israel specifically, the Jews fleeing the Holocaust were told this is a land without a people for a people without a land.
Yeah.
That the people who were there were not considered fully human. They were not considered to be people who had a claim to the land that was legitimate. And the same thing was true here, where, you know, I really want to come back to this word pilgrim, because the very word pilgrim is part of the mythology of the founding myth, you know, the founding myth of the United States, where an innocent group of people were fleeing religious persecution and they came to America's hospitable shores and they came here to the land of opportunity and they started a new life. That's a myth. So the people who we call pilgrims today were in reality Christian separatists who had a very, you know, a different, more rigid, now we call puritanical version of Christianity. And they wanted to break with the people in England and come to this place and establish a holy land here. And they knew full well that the land was full of people, because this was, you know, the 1620s. For over a century, you know, since the time of Columbus, there had been Native American slaves brought back to England who people had seen. So they knew those people were here when they came, and they had every plan and every intention of taking their land away.
And you know what? Even the notion of America being discovered is problematic for me, because when you have land that's already been inhabited, how can you discover land? It's like, for instance, when British went to subcontinent to India, they didn't discover India. India was already inhabited. And it same goes for the US. And this goes back to the notion of whitewashing everything. But to me, and that's why I'm struggling with this whole notion of how do I celebrate Thanksgiving moving forward? Because as I said, it's such an important holiday for me. But now it's different now, and I don't know how to celebrate it moving forward. How do I honor Native Americans while I am giving gratitude and being thankful for all the stuff that I have?
It's so hard, because, you know, I really, in reflecting on this holiday this year, I thought about how we as immigrants are actually even, you know, differently positioned in relation to Thanksgiving than other people, because the founding myth that the very first, as you say, first, like there's nobody here, immigrants, so to speak, to the United States were these pilgrims, and they were fleeing persecution. And ever since then, there's been generation after generation of immigrants who have come to American shores and been welcomed here. And I'm part of that legacy, right? I'm sort of my lineage as a refugee fleeing the Soviet Union goes all the way back to this idea of people throughout America's history who were fleeing other places coming here. And then I learn actually, the first people who came here were not exactly as they were described, and the legacy of that is very different from what I had thought. And it's really hard to reconcile. It brings me back again to the lemon tree, this idea that America welcomed me to this land as an immigrant while denying the right of return to the people who were here. And Native people, like Palestinians, have had to watch generation after generation of immigrants being invited and welcome to come to America to settle on their ancestral indigenous lands. So it is really hard. And I feel like the same conflict because I love Thanksgiving. And there's, you know, our kids bring like such an innocence about Thanksgiving too.
Yeah.
And you want to give them that. But at the same time, it's messed up. And I have to tell you, I was reading one of these books to my kids, and I came downstairs from their room to talk to my husband, and I told him what I was doing. He said, you know, he had some concerns about me talking to the kids about genocide and what it might do to them or how they might react. And I said, let me just show you something. And I showed him this brochure that my son had brought from his kindergarten, and it was published by Scholastic, and it was about Thanksgiving. And on the front was, you know, so what happened at the first Thanksgiving? The children helped. And on the left, there was a picture of a brown-skinned girl. And on the right, there was a picture of a white girl with blonde hair. And they were supposed to represent the Wampanoag children and the Pilgrim children. And they're both holding baskets of whatever seasonal harvest, supposedly helping at the first Thanksgiving. So first things first, the brown-skinned girl was like Dominican. She definitely was not a Native child. Like they couldn't even find a Native child to represent in this totally fictionalized account. And then just the whole idea of children helping at this thing is so crazy because the first Thanksgiving was actually a rejoicing, and everybody was like shooting guns and drinking. And the reason why the Wampanoag even came there was because the Pilgrims were shooting guns and they had a mutual defense pact. And the Wampanoag were thinking that the Pilgrims were being attacked. This was not like a kids carrying baskets of corn around kind of thing. And then just the idea that everything was like so la-di-da and everybody was so friendly and it was so lovely. You know, my husband looked at that, Mark looked at that and said, like, this is so preposterous. I was like, I know, that's why I had to go and buy these children's books that were recommended by Native people to read so that our kids learn something true. So I think the answer to your question, how to go forward, to embrace all of the ambiguity and the internal contradictions that this is, that giving thanks is really beautiful and being with family is really beautiful and making new family is beautiful. And there's all this messiness and dirtiness underneath it that we also have to grapple with. And, you know, to kind of just put a coda on what I tried to do. So after the Thanksgiving and after everybody left, the next day I was thinking, what do? I had all these materials prepared. So I sent an email to all of my guests saying, you know, as with every great occasion, something's left unfinished and it's not just the turkey. You know, I had all this stuff prepared that I really want to share with you. So let me share it with you now. So here's this podcast I hope you'll listen to from the Red Nation. And here's a link to find out what tribal lands you're on. And by the way, my friend who's really steeped in kind of Native American issues and struggles just sent me a petition to sign to support the work of the Apache people on protecting an indigenously a very sacred land to the Apache people called Oak Flat from mining and exploration. And if you're interested in engaging with a contemporary Native American ask for solidarity, I can send you that. So we'll see what comes of that. I'm giving people time and space to reflect on it.
Did anybody respond?
No.
See, that's the thing, Lisa. I feel like issues like this are so divisive and so polarizing. People just sometimes just want to have fun and not think about the difficult topics or difficult issues. And I've seen that, as I said, even my husband was like, oh, let's not talk politics on this trip. And that's where I somehow don't understand how to draw this line where I am trying to talk about issues that matter without making other people just uncomfortable. But then if you don't make them uncomfortable, how do you broach these subjects?
Like, well, I think you know, this is also so typically American that, like, we're taught that life is about enjoyment and consumption and fun. And what is everybody looking for in the United States? It's the pursuit of happiness, right?
Yeah.
It's not necessarily the pursuit of meaning and purpose. You know, it's sort of like the dopamine versus the serotonin. We click and we are get hits and we're supposed to be having fun in the eternal present. But for me, it's been really revelatory to think about it really as a quest for meaning and purpose, which doesn't mean you're always happy. It means sometimes you're uncomfortable and sometimes you're really, really sad, you know, because you're actually thinking about really sad things, but you're always on this quest to have a more meaningful and more honest life. And it is hard because it's like everybody's at the party and you're the one who's yelling from across the room, there was something horrible that happened here. You guys need to put down your champagne flutes and, like, get with the program here. It's really hard. And I think the way to do it is to be more gentle and understand that you're kind of pushing this cross current against the whole current of American culture, which is about a deep forgetting and erasure of where things came from and what came before, because everybody just wants to feel entitled to what they have now.
And again, I think there is this dissonance between what American values are and what we really practice, what American history is. And I always give example of Germany. Germany has reconciled with its history to some extent, and they have realized or recognized the horrors of their history. And until and unless the U.S. does that, we will have a lot more senseless wars. We will have a lot more bigotry and discrimination because Americans have this notion, egoistic ideals of how great they are.
Yeah. And I think what we really need, which is so hard to do here because America has this idea of itself as being so exceptional and outside of history and not needing the same kinds of mechanisms and processes that have worked in other places, but we really need like a truth and reconciliation commission.
We do.
You know, we need like something on a really grand scale that goes beyond, you know, Saudi and Lisa at their Thanksgiving, annoying their husband because they're also having social justice issues or trying to interrupt their guests. We need something society-wide that gives a space for, you know, collective traumas and that gets us away from you individually are bad and you individually are racist and you are supposed to fix this instead of just enjoying your turkey. It really needs to happen on that grand a scale, but that's so hard to do in a country that is just very ahistorical.
On a lighter note, though, what about like menu on Thanksgiving? Because I don't like turkey. So if I were to get rid of anything about Thanksgiving other than how it's celebrated or how I celebrate it in my household, my desi taste buds are just, turkey is not palatable and not friendly to my desi taste buds. Do you like turkey though? Like, do you have taste for it?
So I don't really love turkey. I kind of feel about turkey like I feel about capri pants. Like, you can do it better or worse, but it's never as good as like a skirt or shorts or pants or basically anything else you can wear in the bottom half of your body. So same thing with turkey. Like, you can make it better with a lot of effort, but it shouldn't be anybody's go-to. That said, Mark, my husband, is a really excellent chef, and he's also like a truly methodical human being. So he sees every meal and every year's Thanksgiving as a chance to improve. So he's been researching, and now he salt brines the turkeys like 2 days in advance and does all this preparation, and then he smokes them on the grill over charcoal, and they turn out about as good as a turkey can. And I say they because even though we only had 15 people, he truly overdid it and got two turkeys because he was worried about not having enough turkey. So then we had to do this like turkey Tetris in our oven and try to do everything at the same time and move them around. So they're just these birds all over the kitchen. But I think we do turkey as just about as well as you possibly can. But we also do a leg of lamb with Middle Eastern spices.
You know, that's a great idea. I'm seriously thinking about doing that next year. Just leg of lamb, not turkey at all. Because I feel like the day it's cooked, we still try to eat. And I emphasize try because most of the time we don't even eat it. It's just a tradition. And now that I'm challenging Thanksgiving traditions as is, I feel like this is one tradition I can just let go off and just replace it with lamb. Why not, right?
I think it's a great idea because in reality, like everyone suffers. The turkeys suffer and the people suffer too. Like, why should we suffer through turkeys that are not even tasty? For people who know me know I'm a huge fan of Shel Silverstein, the children's book author, children's poetry author. And he has a poem that says something like, Sunday dinner isn't sunny and Thanksgiving's just plain blue when you stop and look at dinner from the dinner's point of view.
Yeah.
And I always think about that poem on Thanksgiving and just all the turkeys that have to go to their death just to be like ignored and thrown away.
Do you mix it with dishes from other cultures or is it like specific American? Because in our household, it's just like hardcore American menu. And that's one time when we don't mix and match at all.
We don't. It's not that we have dishes that are kind of uniquely from other cultures, although I've done kind of Russian inflected Thanksgivings, like not at my parents' house, but with my parents' friends, where you have a turkey and then all around it, you just have like pickled things and everything is with beets and like all these traditional Russians called zakuski, which is basically stuff you have with vodka. And then there's a turkey in the middle of all of it. And I think that's not that unusual for immigrant families. But with Mark, we do like a much more traditional American Thanksgiving. That said, we do Middle Eastern spices on the lamb. And this year I made two cranberry sauces. And one of them was also like this hybrid Middle Eastern spice cranberry sauce, because that's a lot of the spices that we have in our pantry because they're just so tasty.
So for us this year, we were obviously in Charleston. So we did not cook at home. We were staying at this Airbnb and we went out and we went to this restaurant called Florence's Kitchen. Wonderful restaurant, great food. So we ate like fried chicken and fried fish, which was a far cry from like bland and dry turkey, but it was really tasty. And then I also tried like fried okra, which is like a southern specialty, although I literally slathered it with like hot sauce because it was so bland for me.
Right.
Although I would have thought that it's fried and it will have all the spices. So our Thanksgiving meal, at least, was a lot more like it was a lot spicier than when we're cooking traditional American food.
Well, you're not the only one. I had the same friend who shared that awesome comedy podcast story with me told me that she was just finishing up her leftovers and they included homemade tamales and Pueblo-style green chilies. So, you know, people are definitely incorporating a lot more flavor from different cultural traditions in their Thanksgiving because, like, mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes, like, it's pretty bland stuff.
I was going to ask you, what did you do with your leftovers?
Oh, we're still eating them. So, you know, we had our Thanksgiving on the Saturday. So our leftovers are not yet like too far gone to eat. And this is one area where my husband and I differ because he really gets sick of things really fast and he wants to like make something new from scratch. And also he did most of the cooking. So by the end of the day, like it wasn't even tasty to him because he'd just been like smelling it all day. Whereas I could eat the same thing for weeks on end. If it's delicious, it's delicious. So I've been like slowly eating up the turkey and like cutting it up for the kids' lunches and for the most part still enjoying it. But I think I'm about done.
You're about done,
I'm
right?
I'm about done. But there is one really funny thing that I have to mention about our Thanksgiving tradition that I didn't say before. So I mentioned before that Mark is a very methodical person and he has a background in operations research, which is basically about optimizing systems. And a few years ago, he optimized Thanksgiving preparations by creating this like amazing flowchart spreadsheet.
Oh my God.
For how to make the meal. And it would have the step, like, peel the sweet potatoes and cube the sweet potatoes and the time, like 10 a.m.
Oh, my God.
At the latest, you have to start it at 10:30. And then the oven, we have two ovens. So which oven everything is going into and when it has to be finished by. So this year, our meal was relatively simple. So there were only 68 steps.
Oh, my God.
But here's the funny part. So he's the one who does it because he's the chef and he's the one who has all the dishes in his mind.
So
and
you're
he's
the able sous chef.
I'm the prep cook. I'm the sous chef. I just chop things until the cows come home. I don't care. I find like methodical, repetitive activity to be very soothing for my brain.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I
do. Oh, my God.
I stuff envelopes. Like any of your listeners who need someone to do something like that, call me up. Except for washing dishes. I don't like to wash dishes.
Oh, I hate washing dishes.
Yeah. But so we had this you know, huge flow chart of all of these things. But the funny thing is that this year Mark didn't make one because he was working so hard. And the morning of our Thanksgiving, I woke up and I was like, I feel too anxious. You've got to do the flow chart. Like, I need to be able to check stuff off or I'll go crazy. So he made one.
This was great, Lisa. We had fun conversation. And I think we gave our listeners something to think about, food for thought, and they can do their own research. And we wanted our listeners to experience what we experienced this time, which was obviously different from what we normally experience. And honestly, initially, when I thought of doing a Thanksgiving episode, I was going to talk about the trip, just the trip and food and how much of a shock Charleston was. But then you and I had this conversation and I felt the need to talk about something that has really affected me this time. But before I wrap up, I just want to share a few quotes from my friends. I had asked them to send me something and basically what Thanksgiving means to them. And they've sent me a few quotes. So I will just share a couple because we don't have time. We've run out of time. So one of my friends, her name is Ruhi. She sent me this quote. "For me, it is time with the family, a time when we cook together, laugh together, make lots of mess and lots of beautiful memories. It is also the day when we take out our Christmas tree and decorate it. It's my favorite day of the year and by far the favorite holiday." And not everyone celebrates Christmas in our community, but she does. Mm-hmm. Another quote from Rabia, she wrote, "For me, it's a family tradition now. And I look forward to it every year. It's time for caring and sharing, brings the family together in the best of ways. It's a happy time." And lastly, for Syrah, "For me, it's the whole Thanksgiving weekend that I look forward to. Kids are back from school, unlimited time with friends, guilt-free eating, and the only time of the year that I actually shop. It's also only 4-day long weekend at work." She's a doctor, so this is the only time she gets. And what really was interesting for me was that when I was reading all these quotes, it was all about being happy and being with family. And I don't think what you and I talked about today is even part of collective consciousness among Americans. And that's something that I hope can change.
Well, I want to share one quote with you too that really resonated with me, although I can't remember the source now. It was one of the articles that I read in my research, and it said something like, "We're not asking people to have a feel bad Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
We're asking them to have a more honest and inclusive Thanksgiving." And that really resonated with me because people are like, "Don't take my good time. Like,
yes.
Why can't I have nice things? You know, why do you have to ruin the best day of the year?" So we're not asking people to feel bad. We're asking them to just learn more.
And time for some introspection. I think one thing to start off would be what you said. If you could just share that link with all of us.
Sure.
We can just go and see who inhabited this land before, which Native American tribe inhabited the land before we did, and just give them homage and tribute and recognize that it was their land long before it was ours.
Sure. I will share that link with you right now. It's native-land.ca. Again, native-land.ca. And you can go on there and just type in your zip code.
And we will post that on our website when we release this episode and our social media like Facebook, Instagram, so that people can just, if you haven't written it down or noted it, you can just go there and click. Thank you so much, Lisa. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Our merch is out. And if you want to support our podcast, you can do it by either going to our Patreon, subscribing to it, giving one-time donation on our GoFundMe, or buying our merch. Until next time, when I bring you another amazing story.